Back in the 1830s, William Miller, exercising an incredible amount of courage, took to the pulpits of America to warn the world that Jesus was coming back soon. And at the same time, on another part of the globe, a naturalist by the name of Charles Darwin was taking an historic sea voyage on the SS Beagle. Now, the ideas of both of those men have grown over time, and because of it, the Bible says that one day, the whole world will line up on one side of a critical prophetic issue or the other. And the question is, which side are you on? Stick around to find out. My favorite books of the Bible happen to be the first book and the last book, because it seems like most of the stuff that happens in between those two books is either anticipated by the book of Genesis or remembered by the book of Revelation. In the opening chapters of Genesis, you have Adam and Eve living in a perfect paradise created by God. And then, because of sin, they're removed from the garden. They're removed from the tree of life, and they finish out their lives in a world that's been cursed. Because of their rebellion, they have to live with suffering and pain and death. And on their way out of the garden, God promises that the seed of the woman, Messiah, was going to come and undo the curse by crushing the head of the serpent. Then in the very last chapters of the Bible, you find an amazing description of God literally keeping that promise. In the very final words of the Bible, you have the tree of life again, and God finally removes the curse. No more sorrow, no more crying, no more pain, no more death. Behold, I make all things new, God says. The books of Genesis and Revelation dovetail together so beautifully that if you haven't been studying them together, you're really missing out. In the book of Genesis, for example, you have these two cities, Salem, the home of Melchizedek, the righteous priest, and Babel, the city of Nimrod, the great instigator of human pride and rebellion. Now, in Revelation, those same two cities, now called Jerusalem and Babylon, are still compared, side by side. And they're used to describe two kinds of people who live in this world: those who are faithful to God and those who are faithful to themselves. In Genesis, God makes a promise to Abraham that his descendants will be like the stars of heaven and the sand of the sea. Then in Revelation, John sees a crowd so big they can't be numbered, standing on the sea of crystal. In Genesis, you have Jacob and Abram both getting new names from God, and in Revelation, we all get new names from God. The parallels are very important to notice, and the book of Genesis is one of those big keys that helps unlock the meaning of last day prophecy. If you understand Genesis, it will help you understand the book of Revelation. Our beginnings are the key to our destiny. But you know, in the last century and a half, a lot of well-meaning Christians have been shying away from the book of Genesis. They question the creation account because of what they might have heard in a high school biology class. Or they spiritualize those stories so that they have a symbolic meaning and they're not thought of as history. So, here's the situation that comes out of the 19th century. On the one hand, you have preachers like William Miller, lots of preachers like William Miller, pointing to the literal fulfillment of Bible prophecy. They prove quite convincingly that Jesus really is literally coming back, and coming back very soon. Then, on the other hand, you have a growing movement of people who begin to question the creation account. And those two movements happen at roughly the same time. So the question is that a coincidence? Well, on today's episode, we'll begin to explore that idea. But just before we get to it, it's time right now for the Bible in the News. Recently, French officials discovered a man who died in bed 15 years ago, and nobody knew. People just assumed that the house where they found him was abandoned. And I guess in one sense, they were right. It was kind of abandoned because nobody was actually living there. But it wasn't abandoned in the sense that nobody was using the house at all. For 15 years, this guy's body laid in bed, and they continued to deliver his mail, and it piled up, unopened, all the way back to 1996. For 15 years, nobody realized the man was gone. And of course, since the Bible teaches that the dead know nothing, this guy didn't know that nobody missed him. He didn't know, fortunately, that nobody cared. And of course, there's always the possibility he wasn't a very nice person, and maybe that's why nobody seemed to miss him. Maybe he'd been isolated for years already because of a medical condition or a mental illness, or because he'd been hurt so badly by the people around him that he just pulled out of the rat race and kept to himself. We really don't know much about him. We have no idea why he died such a lonely death. But this much I do know. Of all the millions of people who have died alone over the centuries, not one of them has been overlooked in the record books of heaven. Every single grave, or even lack of a grave, has been marked, and every person has been recorded. And the moment is coming when pain and suffering will be reversed. There are two resurrections according to the Bible, and every single human being will be in one or the other. Do not marvel at this, Jesus says in John chapter 5, for the hour is coming in which all who are in the graves will hear his voice and come forth, those who have done good to the resurrection of life, and those who have done evil to the resurrection of condemnation. You and I might not have noticed a lonely man whose dead body laid unattended for 15 years, but I promise you, God noticed. In fact, there's not a single life that gets overlooked, not even one. Everything we do, the tenor of our experience, the fiber of our character, it all gets recorded, and God notices with incredible interest what it is that we did with our time. Was my life about me, or was my life about something bigger? I guess with this guy they found in France, we'll have to wait and see. But with you, it's a decision you can make right now. You actually get to choose which resurrection you take part in. Now, don't you go away, because today I've got Dr. Timothy Standish, the renowned biologist, on the program, and he's going to help me think about human origins and what they have to do with your future.
Of children today in the U.S. are born to single mothers. What realities do single parents face, and what do they need?
Next time on Family Talk, we'll talk about single parenting and how the church can make a positive difference in the lives of these families. Join us.
The Lord reigns forever. He has established his throne for judgment. He rules the world in righteousness and judges the people with equity. The Lord is a refuge for the oppressed, a stronghold in times of trouble. Those who know your name trust in you, for you, Lord, have never forsaken those who seek you.
Today I've got a phenomenal guest on the program, Dr. Timothy Standish, a man who's especially qualified to help me wade through the question of human origins. He's got a PhD in biology and public policy. He's got degrees in zoology, and he teaches genetics. And right now, Dr. Standish, you're with the Geoscience Research Institute.
That's correct. Right?
Yeah, and you know what? I am so embarrassed. I mean, not only are you qualified on the subject that we're going to talk about tonight, but you caught me saying something a moment ago wasn't true.
I think you confused the HMS Beagle with the SS Minnow.
Yes, I did. Yes. Absolutely. At least that's the story I'm going with. That is exactly the mistake I made. It was not a matter of ignorance. It was just a little slip up. It was absolutely ignorance. I should have known that it would have been HMS Beagle, because Darwin was
English. And he served under His Majesty.
That's right. Oh, my goodness. Well, there you go. Well, I bet you before we're done our topic tonight, you will find plenty in my thinking that needs correcting. And that's why.
Well, there you go. I think probably both of us will be in that camp, but that's all right.
Well, listen.
At least we have the Bible that we can refer to and correct ourselves if necessary.
Well, you know, that's one of the wonderful things about it, is that once you realize that God's not trying to condemn people, he's actually trying to save us, and that the information in here, if we're willing to face it, if we're willing to look into the mirror and God says, this is what you actually look like, and here's what I'd like you to be, If you can face what you actually look like, the potential that God puts out there for us is just mind-boggling, and this book proves to be a giant help.
Yes.
Well, listen, let's dig into this, because it's a hot topic everywhere that we go. It comes up in classrooms. It comes up in courthouses, creation, evolution. But the reason that we're going to do it on a program about prophecy is, well, frankly, I love Genesis and Revelation. To me, they're the bookends of the Bible. I think they go together. I think you need one to understand the other. And I'm convinced that origins, where we come from, has a lot to do with whether or not we're going to understand our destiny, where we're going. If you don't know where you came from, how do you know where you're going? And how do you know who you are? So I'm thrilled. I mean, you've got the background to help me wade through this. In your opinion, does origin have anything to do with destiny?
Well, it's absolutely essential. If we don't know where we came from, we're probably not going to know where we are right now or where we're going in the future. And if you look at the Bible with these two books, the beginning, the Genesis, and the Revelation at the end, what you see is a story of a perfect creation, or a very good creation. Those are the exact words that are used in the Bible, and a new creation at the end. If we believe that there was a very good creation at the beginning, that God was involved in that, then we can believe that that same God can do a new creation at the end. So the two go together, and what you'll notice is that what Revelation is prophesying as much as anything is that new creation that God has promised.
It really does. I mean, the Bible seems to be bookended. It begins in the garden, it ends in the garden. Begins with a curse, ends with the curse being lifted. I just love it. I mean, and I think the thing that gets me the most is that God's actually giving everything back, even though we're responsible for having blown it. Anyway, but I imagine that theme will come up.
And the sense of that even is there in the beginning. God puts human beings in charge. He says, I'm giving you dominion over everything. And we proceed to blow it, and it's God who comes down to earth, becomes one of us. Jesus Christ, you know, God with us, and he's the one who wins it back for us. It's an amazing...
The Bible calls him a second Adam. It's like we get to opt into one family or the other. Yeah. I love it. Well, listen, a moment ago I was talking about William Miller, and the reason I brought him up is that for a number of weeks on Disclosure, we've gone through the seven churches. We've looked at Christian history as it unfolded. We looked at the Church of Philadelphia in one program, and if you didn't see that, it's archived right here on the Hope Channel website.
And so you're not talking about Philadelphia here in the United States?
No, this is Philadelphia in Asia Minor. Yes. And we saw how that reflected a period of history known as the Great Awakening, First and Second Great Awakening, or some scholars will say it was really just one awakening. It kind of comes to a peak with William Miller in the 1830s, preaching the second coming of Christ. We've come out of the Dark Ages, and now prophecy's big, and Christ is coming. And what I find fascinating is that as William Miller is preaching the prophecies of the Bible, and he's preaching the second coming of Christ, after the Millerite movement, we move into a period known as Laodicea, and Jesus introduces himself to the church in Laodicea as the Creator. He says, I'm the beginning of creation. So you've got William Miller preaching the second coming of Christ, and for that generation, Jesus said, don't forget, I'm the Creator. And at the same time, you've got Darwin on the HMS Beagle. I want to get it right. Is it a coincidence that these things are taking place? And I want to speak to you now as a Christian rather than a scientist and a Bible believer. Does that happen by accident that these two movements are building at the same time?
I don't believe that it does. I believe that really over the course of history, what we're seeing is this great controversy between good and evil. And obviously the champion of good is God himself. And evil is championed by the devil, a very intelligent being, a very powerful being, and one who is quite capable of seeing what God is doing and attempting in various ways to somehow or other stop God's will being executed here in the world. He's the being who claims to be the prince of this world. Now that human beings who God put in charge handed it over to him, that's the claim that he makes. And he's not willing to surrender it back, even though Jesus himself has won it back. He's not ready to do that yet. And so, yes, God is being revealed. People are discovering these truths that are in His Word, and the devil is going to do something.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think he's got to come up with something. If you look at the 19th century, I do want to get back to Darwinism, but all these isms explode on the scene. You've got Russellism, which comes up with another story for the second coming. You've got spiritualism, which tells a different story about death. And you've got Marxism, which has human beings creating paradise by their own work here on earth. And all these isms. Darwinism is one of them. But Darwin wasn't doing anything brand new, right?
No,
this didn't come out of thin air.
I was just thinking about this. At the time of Christ, when he did come, the first advent, the devil more or less was using the same tactics. Do you remember when Paul went to Mars Hill, the Areopagus there in Athens? And in Acts 17, it tells us about that. It tells us the philosophers who he spoke with. And there were two major schools there. There were the Stoics and there were the Epicureans. And particularly the Epicureans, they believed in evolution. You can read what they wrote. They talk about the world and everything coming about by the random, unguided interaction of the atoms. And from this random interaction, the living things emerge as well.
Sounds vaguely familiar.
It does sound vaguely familiar. That's the world that Jesus Christ was born into, a world that intellectually is amazingly similar to the world that we live in today.
Well, you know, I often find, and I don't want to sidetrack because I want to get back to Darwinism not arising in a vacuum, but I find it interesting that at the beginning of the book of Hebrews, Paul says, by faith we understand that the worlds were framed by the Word of God. And I've looked at that and thought, so many people say they had to believe that because they were ignoramuses and they were primitive. But back then they were saying, don't forget, by faith we know that God created. They were competing with other ideas.
Exactly. And the interesting thing to me is, by sticking with God's Word, talking about what God had revealed to them, they prevailed. It's an incredible thing.
Yeah. So I'm not afraid that somehow secular Darwinism is going to triumph over Christianity. We've been holding our own because of who's behind our faith for 2,000 years. But back to Darwinism. 1842, about when the Millerites are getting ready for their, what proved to be a disappointment, but anticipating the second coming. We've studied that on the program too. In 1842, Darwin is busy.
Yes. Oh, yeah. He's sailing around the world. No, he isn't. He's finished his sailing around the world. He's writing down his ideas. Now, the important thing to understand is these ideas were not new to him.
Right.
If you go back to his time in Embra, when he was becoming, he thought he was doing medicine. He was following in his father's footsteps. And medicine didn't work out for him. But he was interacting with lots of scholars there who were extremely skeptical. And he, we can read in his notebooks, is becoming a materialist.
Okay.
And he says that about himself in his own notebooks. You know, he sort of accuses himself of being a materialist.
So he's very honest, is he?
Oh, yes, you know, at least to himself. Now, he was also a very clever man. And I don't want to say this in a way that is disparaging. He was a very smart man. He knew how to play his cards. He knew who to interact with and so on. So he had these ideas. You know, the problem with being a materialist is you still have to account in some way for where everything came from.
Right.
So, for example, his great-grandfather, he came up with this slogan for himself, which essentially translates from the Latin as, everything came from shells.
Oh, no.
That's what he believed. There were other theories of evolution before Darwin. But Darwin, he begins to formulate the idea of natural selection working on natural variation in organisms, and that then leads into his theory that organisms could vary infinitely, essentially. You could take an amoeba, and through natural selection and natural variation in that amoeba, it would eventually turn into a giraffe or a flamingo. Or a sea anemone.
Oh, wow.
Or a Sean Boonstra.
Oh, well, yeah. You know, I wouldn't doubt that my ancestors had very humble beginnings and that we were amoeba-like. In some ways, we still are amoeba-like. this idea takes root, Miller's idea takes root, because to this day people are still preaching an imminent return of Christ, which was not the idea. And his ideas take root. Darwin's ideas take root. And it sets the table for some interesting things. Christians over the next, well, I guess it's 1939, the Church of England takes on Darwin evolution as their official position. Eventually, it makes its way into Christianity. And after our break, which is, I can't believe we're up against a break already, I want to explore the idea, if we try to reconcile the Darwinian theory with biblical Christianity, do we run into trouble? And that's the question I want to explore with you in just a moment. And a little later in the program, you're going to get your chance to jump into the discussion. Here's what you need to know to join us. Go to hopetv.org/disclosure. You can find us on YouTube. You can look us up on Facebook. Just go to Facebook and look for Disclosure Live. You can call us right here on the set, 888-730-HOPE. 888-730-HOPE. Or send me a text message. I'll get it right here on my iPad, 707-200-1099. And in just a few moments, we're going to be right back with a little more discussion with Dr. Timothy Stander. So don't you go away. This is going to be worth your while.
As I was reading through The Great Hope, this caught my attention. God did listen to the cries of His servants. He gave to princes and ministers grace and courage to maintain the truth against the rulers of the darkness of this world. The Protestant reformers had built on Christ, and the gates of hell could not prevail against them. Here's why this brings me hope. In the days of the Reformation, during the turmoil and the struggle and the persecution, God did listen to the prayers of His servants, and He protected them. God listens to His followers today, and He gives us grace and courage. And hell cannot prevail against us.
And we are back from our break. Don't forget, you can call us here on the set at 888-730-HOPE. That's 888-730-4673. You know, every time I do that, I sound like I'm on a telethon on PBS. Call the number now and donate. Actually, you could probably do that too. I don't think they would say no at Hope Channel if you called the number to donate. But you can also call to ask a question of Dr. Stanish in a coming
segment. People can donate a question as well.
You can donate a question tonight. And ask your toughest questions. I want something that can't be answered. Actually, there's...
Hey, you know what?
That's part of the problem, isn't it?
You're going to get an answer.
We have two Commonwealthers on the set tonight. Neither of us is actually American.
It's terrifying, isn't it?
It is kind of terrifying. Well, listen, during the break, you mentioned a name to me, William Wilberforce, and I was interested in what you were saying and thought I'd ask you when we came back from the break to share it and broaden it a little bit, because Darwin not only had implications for people's scientific thought, it had implications on the social world as Christians began to dabble in Darwinism, and the public at large began to dabble in it and accept these ideas.
Exactly. What I was doing was I was going back and thinking about the statement that you made about the Church of England sort of adopting this idea of evolution and how things actually started out. You know, most people imagine that when Darwin came out with The Origin of Species, which was in 1859, that suddenly all of the church people just sort of jumped all over him and the scientific people stepped back and they were like, no, science has now triumphed over religion or something like that. Actually, the opposite was true. Many people, many theologians, incorporated the idea of long periods of time and evolution into their theology. But there was an event that had occurred before this, and it was probably the greatest event in the history of the world when it comes to the emancipation of human beings. And this all came back to the Christian beliefs of an individual named William Wilberforce.
Okay.
He was a politician in England. What he did, based on his Christian beliefs and the Christian beliefs of the English people at the time, he argued for the elimination of slavery in the British Empire, okay, to their own cost, by the way.
Right.
This is before the Emancipation Proclamation or anything like that here in the United States. without any war or anything like that, England and the empire eliminated slavery.
Interesting.
The largest empire, I believe, that's ever existed in the history of the world emancipated all slaves in one fell swoop because of their beliefs about human beings, that we are all the descendants of Adam and so on. So it shouldn't be surprising that his son, Samuel Wilberforce, Bishop Samuel Wilberforce, argued against Darwinism. He was one of the actually relatively few religious leaders who went out on a limb with this. And there's a very apocryphal account of this debate that he had with Huxley, an individual named Huxley, Thomas Henry Huxley,
right,
in which Huxley is supposed to have made an idiot of him. The truth is, if you go back and look at the historical record, it looks suspiciously like that magnificent triumph by Huxley may not have happened at the time. It happened later on in the imagination of somebody. People have cared about this issue because of the impact that it has on human beings, what we think about humans and how we will treat one another.
Well, you know, and I find this interesting because I talk to a lot of skeptics, and I find most skeptics good people, and many of them sincere and don't know the answers, but they'll often say, look at slavery. It's Christian thinking that creates slavery, and it was cold secular reasoning that liberated people from it.
These are people who obviously haven't heard of individuals like Livingston, for example, David Livingston. What was he doing there in Africa? He was there trying to eliminate the slave trade. That was an active part of his work there in Africa. Look, nobody's claiming that Christians have been perfect.
Right.
We all know that we as Christians are fallen human beings just like everybody else. And as a consequence of that, we have a huge amount to be ashamed of.
Sure, we do.
But that doesn't make Christianity right or wrong. The point is, when Christians follow the precepts of this book, we are better people for it.
I think, and that is one of the keys. That's why it's so important for understanding destiny. We were created with a high purpose, and in spite of our sin, God still has a high purpose in mind for us through Christ.
Yes.
Let me ask you a question. As a scientist and a believer, if we were to try and reconcile Darwinian evolution and Christian belief, what kinds of problems do we run into in our Bible and in our thinking?
Well, obviously, there are a number of different ways that Christians have tried to do that. There are three that we could talk about, and I don't know how much detail we can get into in each one of them. One of these ideas is called the day-age theory.
Right.
And in that, what happens is that story there in Genesis 1 and 2 of the 6 days of creation is turned into the story of six eons of time,
right,
essentially.
I've heard this a lot.
Yes. The fundamental problem with this idea is that basically, you can't escape having death before sin.
Right.
And so what Paul, for example, says about the wages of sin being death, and how through sin death came into the world, obviously doesn't make any sense. So the New Testament stops making sense. The idea of salvation, you know, if sin didn't cause death, and Jesus won this victory over sin, I mean, what exactly was he doing up there on the cross? It doesn't, you know, how does this all work together? It stops making sense.
Right. There's a key prophetic passage in 1 Corinthians where Paul says, the hope that we have in the future is that Jesus rose from the dead, and that why one man sin came into the world, he's conquered it. If I'm hearing you right, if we believe that death existed before sin, then God actually created death as part of our existence, and the only thing he's reconciling at the cross is his own mistake.
Presumably, yes.
Yeah. I mean, I don't believe that.
Yes.
I want to be clear that that is not the position that I hold.
Yes.
But
other ideas have to do with things they're different flavors of the same thing. But there's an idea of progressive creation, where God sort of steps in and he creates something, and he's sort of adding to things and tinkering with things, if you want, until we get to the point where where we are today. And but again, you have death before sin.
Right.
Then you have the idea of theistic evolution, which also incorporates death before sin. And that's pretty much like straight out normal Darwinism. For some reason or other, this death-driven process of Darwinian evolution happens to be the divinely inspired method that God uses to bring all the creation to fruition.
But what does that say about God? I mean, one of the big prophetic themes is the question over the character of God. Lucifer questions his character. What kind of God is this? Is he fair and just? I mean, the books are open so people can settle that question. If God used theistic evolution, if that's the way it worked, what did he create? What does it say? I mean, we have to suffer our way up the ladder?
Well, that does make me wonder a lot about salvation. You know, we've been talking about the idea of, there's the idea of the new creation there at the, in Revelation. Well, if it took billions of years the first time around, how many deaths do you and I have to die before we're better people?
No, exactly. Here's a quick question. I know we have to take a break. I'm actually going to cough right on the air. There you go.
That was a good
first.
Cough.
That was a good one. Yeah. You're a microbiologist. You might be interested in that. But the question I want to ask you, and we might have to come back to it after the break, was there actually an Adam? Was Adam a real person?
I believe there was. Jesus Christ believed there was. Yeah, no first Adam, no second Adam.
That makes sense. You know, and I think it's in the Gospel according to Matthew. He makes reference to marriage being something that developed in the garden. God put the man and the woman together. And nowhere did he say, remember that story? Do you remember these characters? He speaks of Adam as literally having been real. And if God was just using myth in Genesis, that would have been an ideal opportunity for Jesus to say, here's a parable. But he doesn't say it. He doesn't say it. So Adam is real. I want to ask you a few questions. You have brought some toys along, and we're going to have to take a break. But I have been looking at your fossilized fish, which is so well preserved, it looks like it happened yesterday. And you've got some other things that I want to ask you about. But we're going to take a quick break and come back and talk about the age of the earth and some of the other questions that people have. And if you want to ask a question, you can call us, 888-7380-HOPE. You can text a question to 707-200-1099. Look us up on Facebook, go to the website. We're going to take a quick break and we're going to come right back after this.
When Jesus built the church that he calls my church, he gave some special services, blessings, to those who are part of his church. This week on Hope Sabbath School, we'll talk about baptism and foot washing and the communion service. Profound blessings from our Savior to those who are part of his church. We hope you'll join us for Hope Sabbath School.
Stanish, we are talking about evolution versus creation. We're discovering that it's a huge theme in Bible prophecy. In fact, there's a last day message that goes to the whole world in Revelation chapter 14 that hinges on what you believe in prophecy or about creation, isn't it?
Exactly, yes. You're thinking of the first angel's message.
The first angel's message. It's right there
in Revelation 14, 6 and 7. And there are two components to it. By the way, it's very important to remember, it's set up by telling us this is the everlasting gospel. This is what Christians are supposed to preach to all the world with a loud voice.
Right.
Yes.
So this is not an incidental message. This is the main thrust in the last
exactly.
moment.
Exactly. And so what is the wonderful news? God's judgment. Whoa.
Right.
You know, a lot of people will be very worried about that. And the second thing is worship the Creator.
Right. Worship Him who made
heaven and earth, the sea, the fountains of waters.
Major theme through the entire Bible that comes to a head in the book of Revelation.
Precisely. You know, I will admit that throughout the course of my life, I've been kind of worried about that judgment.
Right.
But I think that I'm beginning to understand it a little bit more. You think about how many times in the Bible people ask, where did all of this evil come from? Life isn't like a cowboy movie where the good guy wins every time and gets the girl and rides off into the sunset. Yeah. What happens in real life is the good guy sometimes dies young, poor, and miserable. And the bad guy prospers.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you have that, Jeremiah talks about it. Why do the wicked prosper? And so on. Why is there this terrible injustice that we see? Why does anybody have to suffer and die? Why does the rest of the creation groan, as Paul puts it in Romans 8:20, I believe it is. Talking about the whole creation groaning. Because of sin that's in the world. Why is that? The Bible provides an explanation, but the explanation is that we are not experiencing the justice,
exactly,
the judgment of God. We are experiencing the injustice that we've chosen for ourselves and unleashed on ourselves, the devil's injustice, basically. Life is all about struggle and competition and survival of the fittest and those sorts of things, at least in that Darwinian view. Obviously, the biblical view is quite different.
Right.
Life is about cooperation with the Creator. And that's what this is calling us to do. It's saying, don't worry, worship the Creator God. Worship the Creator God because He will recreate you. You will be born again.
Hey.
You don't have to fear that judgment. You will look forward to that judgment when God will set all things right. He will wipe away all tears.
And I love the fact that the Bible says, I will be there. With Darwin, yes. I'm here for a brief moment and never to be again. But I'll be there. Well, we've got Steve on the line with a question for you, Doctor. Steve, how are you doing tonight?
I am okay. How are you?
I think I'm okay. I've got a little cough going on, and I think I ruined somebody's ears in the sound booth. But other than that, I'm doing great. Have you got a question for Dr. Stanish?
Yes. My question would be, where did the dinosaurs come from?
That's a great question. Yes.
I also want to insert this because my teacher in biology mentioned this week that humans are 99% chimpanzee.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
So
Let me just address that very quickly. I don't want to be mean to your teacher, but your teacher is absolutely unfamiliar with the literature. Since the chimpanzee genome has been sequenced, the estimate of similarity has gone down to about 96%. Other estimates are lower than that. And as we get into looking at how the chromosomes are arranged and so on, what you see in a very detailed way, sort of expressions of astonishment in the literature about how different some of the chromosomes are. The Y chromosome, for example, is profoundly different, and several of the others have been explored in other levels of detail. However, let me not be too mean about that. The bottom line is this. Chimpanzees are a lot more like us. I would be shocked if the plans for chimpanzees were not a lot more like us than, let's say, a snail. Of course, there are similarities. All living things share similarities. If you go back and read the Bible, you'll see that the Bible is actually very explicit that God created human beings in the same way that He created the animals. He made us out of the same stuff. He created us by using the earth itself. We're made out of the same stuff, and by breathing the breath of life into us. That's how He made the animals as well. A lot of Christians forget this, and it's a bad thing to forget.
Yeah.
Yes, God made us in the same way. We shouldn't be surprised that there are similarities between us. At the same time, there are obviously profound differences. And the difference between us and other animals is not that we're made out of something different, it's that God made human beings in His own image and gave us the responsibility of caring for the rest of creation.
Let's take, Steve, you also asked about dinosaurs, but before we get to them, I want to look at your toys for a moment.
Oh, okay.
And we will get back to that question, where do the dinosaurs come from?
Well, but it just so happens that I have a couple of fragments of dinosaur bone here with me. The reason that I bought them is that one of the biggest questions that people have about dinosaurs is, when did they exist? And the current theory is that they all went extinct about 65 million years ago. The problem is that recently there has been soft tissue found in some dinosaur bones.
Oh, no kidding.
And yes.
That's very resilient tissue.
Well, that is very resilient tissue. We know experimentally that soft tissue doesn't last that long. You can do this experiment at home, by the way, with a chicken egg or something. Put it into vinegar, leave it for a while. You'll see that it's actually kind of a rubbery material that's left behind. That stuff doesn't last that long. Experiments have been done so that you can tell how old bodies are and so on. 65 million years? No, that's out of the question. It makes these bones look actually remarkably young. I'm shocked that it could last for thousands of years, to be honest with you.
Sure.
So there's evidence even from dinosaurs that perhaps those fossils are not quite as old as people have assumed they are.
But where did the dinosaurs come from?
Where did they come from?
Where do they come from?
I believe that personally that dinosaurs came from the same place as all other animals, and that is that God created them. If you look at dinosaurs, they're not all big vicious things like T-Rex or something like that. What they are animals that are very similar to other animals. They're very well adapted to the environment that they live in. Many of them were vegetarian. They're not all huge. I mean, some of them are as small as a turkey, basically.
Right.
It's only the exceptional ones that are huge T-Rex things. That's why we get so excited about them. So I believe that like mammals or birds or whatever, dinosaurs were created, and that they were beautiful creatures, and that after the fall, obviously things started going wildly wrong. Beautiful cats turned into death-dealing lions and tigers,
right.
And so on. So, I personally look forward to that time when God does the new creation. I really hope that there'll be some dinosaurs there to study, that he won't leave those off the list.
Me too. The one exception being Barney the dinosaur, because I don't think anybody could handle him for all eternity.
No, all of us who've had young children understand that, we understand what eternity is just to sit
just
through
to
that.
Just sit through Barney for half an hour, absolutely. You've got a few more fossils to show.
Sure.
We are going to have to take another break and some pictures to look at.
One last thing. Let's just look at this fish. It's three-dimensional. This is an amazing fossil. Many fossils give an indication that they were produced in a very rapid way, fossils like this. And they don't represent, in the process of fossilization, millions of years. Now, you might say that there's millions of years in between, but it's kind of interesting that so many throughout the fossil record, these trilobite fossils, similar sort of thing, they look like they were buried very rapidly and fossilized fast. And as a consequence of that, we can say that rapid fossilization is something that we see throughout the fossil record. It doesn't require millions of years to build it up. What it requires is actually a very special set of circumstances to make the fossil in the first place.
We're going to take a break. I want to come back and ask you a question about how old the Earth is.
So all right.
Hold that thought, and we're going to be back in just one moment.
You and teach you in the way you should go. I will counsel you with my loving eye on you.
And we are back from the break, and I have discovered that we really need a three-hour show on disclosure. our topic started with, do you need to understand origins to understand destiny? The answer is absolutely yes. Creation is a huge theme in the book of Revelation, and it is important for us to get our minds around it. Dr. Standish, I got a question for you. You know, is the earth a few thousand years old?
I believe it is.
Okay.
And that's a question that obviously needs some unpacking. Probably the number one attack on the authority of Scripture is this business of time. And what we're going to do with it. If you look at prophecy, it's all about time as well. Now, the Bible has proven to be extremely accurate when it comes to dealing with periods of time. You know, all of those time prophecies, like in Daniel and so on, they all work out. And William Miller, who we started off with, he was looking at a time prophecy there. And so getting our minds around time and the Bible is an important thing. There's a generic way of looking at time. You know, let me just state up front. There is no way of knowing from the Bible the exact day of creation.
Right.
There have been people who actually suggested that God started the creation. I believe it was on Sunday morning. In fact, it had to be Sunday morning, obviously.
First day of the week.
The first day of the week. Sunday morning, 9 a.m., 4,000, October 22, ironically, I think, 4004 BC.
Wow.
The reason that Christians believe that that life, at least, is on the, you know, around 6,000 years old or so, is because of genealogies that are given in the Bible.
Right.
So-and-so begat so-and-so, and they were such and such an age.
Incidentally, all those genealogies of real people lead back to Adam.
Yes.
And Adam's in the list of real people.
Yes, exactly. You know, where do we go to the mythical people in there? There's no clean break to make, obviously. Well, when you start adding those numbers up, the ages of those people when they had children and so on, you quickly see that these are like the kind of numbers that we deal with as scientists. Numbers only have so much precision to them. So if I say, well, I flew 3,000 miles to get here, it's about 3,000 miles, but it's not exactly 3,000 miles. We all understand that. And when we start adding up numbers like that, there's going to be a little bit of error that's in there. So we can't be that precise. It depends a little bit on how people started counting how old people are. But anyway, when it's all said and done, we go off genealogies that are given here in God's Word. How else would we know how old the earth is? We have some techniques that might be used, like radiometric dating, for example.
Right.
All of those are based on certain assumptions that may or may not be correct. The truth is that it is a lot easier to know that something happened than to know when it happened. That's just the nature of knowledge itself. So I believe that you can look at the creation and you can say, yes, it's pretty obvious that it happened, or at least that there's very good evidence that it occurred. But knowing when it occurred, particularly when we take into consideration that once you believe that God was active in that creation, knowing when is just something that you can't necessarily figure out any other way than being told. The analogy that I would use is something like when I look at my car. The truth is, I don't know whether it took a week to make that car, or whether it took a month to make it, or whether it took 6 hours. I don't know. Presumably somebody does. There's probably a record there in the car factory that says, that car with that VIN number started out at such and such a time on such and such a day, and it rolled off the production line at such and such a time on such and such a day. It's a written record. There's no other way of knowing.
Okay. Right.
So the Bible tells us that the earth, life, God molded the earth and then put life on it in 6 days. How else would I know? There is no other way of knowing. This is God telling us. The same is really true with when it occurred.
Yeah.
Okay. How else would I know? Well, the Bible gives me a written record that tells me approximately when that happened, now, but not exactly.
One of the things I like about it is we have a lot of questions. We weren't there.
Yes.
And so we don't have any observational records of what God did, but the Bible says God's going to create the earth anew. Isaiah 65, Isaiah 66, 2 Peter chapter 3. He's going to make a new heavens and a new earth. Here's a question I want to ask you as a biologist. I mean, I can imagine artists are going to watch for God doing certain things. Physicists want to see what God does with light. In the moments we have left, what does a biologist want to watch God create?
Well, you know, different biologists have different obsessions. I want to know what God's going to do with the bacteria.
Okay.
It is so amazing what bacteria do. We forget things like, here's an interesting factoid for you. Human beings have more bacterial cells inside their body than they have human cells. And those bacteria are doing all kinds of things that keep us happy and just living our lives, not thinking about all of those bacteria that are coordinating their activities with ours. Yes, we help them out as well. We provide a beautiful, moist, and nutrient-filled environment in our gut. But it's not just in our gut. It's all over our body. We have these organisms that are living, and we're an ecology. And yet, every now and again, we know of a bacterium that goes wrong in some way. Streptococcus, you know, the strep bacteria. Normally, we live with it very, very happily. Occasionally, something goes wrong, and we get strep throat.
Right.
For example, when these things go wrong, it's really bad. So I want to see what God does with these bacteria.
You know, I don't think I'm going to sleep nearly as well tonight as I thought I was going to. I'll be thinking about the fact that I'm mostly crawling bacteria.
Well, only if you do it by numbers of cells. Remember that bacterial cells are a lot smaller than human cells. So we're bigger than them.
Oh, boy. I remember seeing a special one time about the microorganisms that live in your eyelashes, and I can't get that out of my mind.
Well, without them, we'd be so unhappy.
I'm quite happy to have them there. I'm not so happy about thinking about it or knowing about it. But I can't believe we have run out of time for this evening. I mean, we have a few more thoughts coming up. Don't you run away. But I really want to thank you for coming in, bringing this fish. Incredible. It's preserved in its entirety, 3D, and I know you're busy and you're in high demand, and I just want to thank you so much for taking the time to come in and share the faith of a scientist. You're a scientist who knows what's going on and yet believes.
Thanks so much. You know, this is the most interesting thing in the world, so I love being here and talking about it.
Ah, thanks so much. Now, don't you go away. I'm going to be right back in a few moments with a few thoughts for you on where you come from and where you're going. You know, we're a needy bunch as human beings because there's a lot of stuff we just can't live without. Now, some of our needs are purely physical. If we go without water or food, we can only survive for a matter of days or weeks. If we don't get oxygen, we only survive for a matter of minutes. There's some stuff that is absolutely essential to a purely physical existence. But you know, there's other stuff we need if we want more than mere physical existence. We need things like love. We have this deep craving to be involved with other people, so much so that it seems like 95% of the songs we listen to are about falling in love, falling out of love, or being in love. There are very few people who doubt that love is a key component to living a high-quality life.
But you know, it seems the most profound need we have is to know that our lives actually mean something, that we're here for a reason. We want to know that when our lives are over, they were actually worth living. We want to know that someone out there knows our name and cares about what happens. And that need stems from the fact that we were created for a purpose. And that has got to be one of the biggest tragedies about the way we've been rewriting the story of human origins. We've managed to convince ourselves that our lives don't really mean anything. We're telling ourselves that we're just the result of some cosmic burp, a bunch of stardust that was hurled into space for no particular reason. You were born, you live, you die, and that's it. All there's to it. No wonder people live the way they do. Without a higher purpose, without a reason for our existence, we just try to fill our lives with stuff. We try to find ways to make ourselves mean something. We try to find fulfillment with stuff like entertainment or money or power or sex or even substance abuse. The way we've chosen to define our own existence has turned us into a dim shadow of what we used to be. But the Jesus who literally walked this earth nearly 2,000 years ago told us, in no uncertain terms, that He's literally coming again. And the prophecies of the Bible have proven century after century that He was absolutely right. Not one of those prophecies has ever been proven false. They've all been coming to pass. And we're down to just the last few things that have to happen before Jesus returns. The second coming is quite literal. And in the last few moments, just before Jesus comes, there's a message that goes to the planet. Fear God and give glory to Him, for the hour of His judgment has come, and worship Him who made heaven and earth, the sea and springs of water. The God who is coming is the same God who put us here in the first place. His greatest desire is to have us live in His presence, and that's the whole reason He made us in the first place. You know, people say our world is improving, that it's getting better all by itself. They say that for some reason the universe is moving upward and onward, even though at the same time they say nobody's directing it. But you know we're not improving. It's not true. The fact is we're not getting better with age. We're getting worse. And God sees what's going on and He promises He's going to do something about it. But just before He comes, He's actually waiting to see if you were interested in a relationship with your Creator. Because in His opinion, an earth made new just wouldn't be the same without you. Our world is falling apart. We see it every day. There's not evolution, there seems to be devolution. Civilization is crumbling and people are still hurting. We don't seem to be improving. We thought technology would fix everything. And here we are suffering like we always have. And the God who loves you has promised an earth made new. And He's promised that you can be there. That's a decision that you can make at this moment. Your destiny is in your hands because the One who made you is offering it. I'm Sean Boonstra. You've been watching Disclosure.